to grab him before he fell over the edge, soaking one leg of her breeches with water in the process. The left side of his body was wet with blood, and as she hooked an arm around him and heaved him to her side, she felt a warm wetness soak through her sleeve. So much blood. What had happened? There were no Kimisar on the path she could see. Sage propped Gramwell against the steep hill and felt around his body, finding an arrow shaft buried almost to the fletching under his ribcage. The angle told her it had come from the valley below. There was light and heat at her back as the Dremvasha ignited, and she prayed to the spirit whoever had fired the arrow would be caught in its rage. "Be still," she told Gramwell. "I'll get you out of here." But the depth and the blood told her there was nothing she could do. She was sure the arrow had pierced his lung, and probably also his heart.
I can't,
he gasped, blood bubbling on his blue lips. There was no place to lay him down, so Sage pulled his hands up to his chest and pinned him upright against the slope. He took a rattling breath, struggling to fill his lungs with air. The pool of blood beneath him expanded.
"Claire," she said, her face hovering over his. "Think of Claire."
Claire,
Gramwell choked, spitting blood.
"Yes, think of how much you love her."
And she stayed with him until he could think no more. Chapter 107. Hazar ran around a bend in the path and stopped short at the wave of heat and light coming from the canyon below. In the rocky slope, a half-buried barrel poured water from a split in its side, but rather than extinguish the fire below, it seemed to add to it. What kind of weapon was this? He gripped his sword and took a few more steps, looking for the bronze-haired Damoran he'd scuffled with a few minutes ago. On the other side of the barrels, the boy on horseback he'd followed out of the bowl stood straight and faced him. Hazar froze in shock as he recognized him. Her. He'd seen her first outside Tagan, when she'd climbed a tree and struck down his hawk with a sling. He'd thought about shooting her then. He'd had a clear shot, but something had stayed his hand. Perhaps it was because she reminded him of Yulara, the sister he'd lost 3 years ago in the famine. In any case, she was relatively harmless. Or so he'd thought. She'd used the same weapon to take down his second-in-command as they pursued the prince along the river. Barely minutes later, he'd watched her defeat two of his men as they tried to climb into the boat with her and the prince, one killed, one badly wounded. And despite all that, he was glad he'd spared her the first time because, spirit shield him, that kind of courage was rare. This woman and Captain Quinn had been his two greatest obstacles in the past year, and he could bring himself to hate neither. Now she stood before him in Kazmuni clothes, her short hair flying in tangles around her face, the left side of her body covered in her companion's blood, a fierce look in her eyes. And Hazar hesitated. In that moment of hesitation, she drew the curved Kazmuni sword from her belt and swung the blade around in a fiery arc reflecting the light below. She struck the barrel of water in front of her, and it split in half, sending gallons of water over the ledge in one rush. Fire exploded below, so intense, Hazar took a step back. Triumph gleamed in the woman's eyes, but the loss of weight in that barrel and the other leaking next to it changed everything. The slope shifted, the earth moving toward the edge, no longer held back by the mass of the contained water. At least one more barrel went over the ledge with it, and Hazar knew whatever was happening below was now beyond anything anyone could stop. The woman scrambled to get out of the way, and Hazar watched in horror as she climbed on top of the sliding landmass, clawing desperately at something to pull herself up with, but finding nothing until she, too, went over the edge. Chapter 108. The fall of 40 feet was considerably less, thanks to the landslides, but it was still quite a distance. Sage landed on her hip, her left hand thrown instinctively out to catch herself, as her right curled around to protect her face. Her left sleeve and her pant leg were drenched in blood and water, and when she tumbled down the mound of earth, she rolled over several shattered jars of Dremvasha, which burst into flame as it touched the moisture on her clothes. She expected to feel heat, but there was none, only pain.
Get out, get out, get out!
When she'd hit the ground, she knew which way was the shortest path out of the fire, but as she screamed and writhed, she lost all sense of direction, all sense of dignity.
Don't touch anywhere else.
It would only get worse if she got more of it on her. Sage lunged in the only direction that seemed possible to move in, and nearly fainted from the wave of agony. Screaming gave her an anchor in consciousness, gave her the energy to lunge again, and again, and again. A tall figure stood on the edge of the fire around her, on her.
Cassock.
He reached out a gloved hand, and she rolled and threw her good arm at him, and he grasped it and yanked her out. The flames followed her from the river of fire as he dragged and rolled her across the sandy ground. Some of the jelly smeared and extinguished briefly before reigniting. Hands on her waist, jerking her breeches down, half the cloth had burned away, and the rest melted to her skin. She cried out as they came apart. Her sleeve was already gone, but Cass tore the edges of that off too. And her glove. The thick glove came away, and she saw it on fire. But it had protected her wrist and hand, though they were blistered. Somehow, they hurt more than... Through a haze of pain, Sage managed to focus on her leg, which was red as raw meat, but still had ashy patches of fabric on it. She reached for one with her right hand, thinking to peel it off, when Cassock grabbed her to prevent it.
I just want to get it off. It doesn't hurt there, she told him.
Those places were islands of calm in the sea of agony that was the left side of her body. And then she saw her left arm, and it was close enough in her pain-blurred vision to see the same patches that were not, in fact, black cloth, but charred skin. She felt no pain there, because there was nothing left to feel. Sage looked back down to her leg, where the skin bubbled and blistered, and fresh waves of pain washed over her. Then she cast herself into the ocean of it, and let the depths swallow her into their blackness. Chapter 109. After the landslide, everyone had stood still, shocked by the explosion of flame and light and heat. But Alex had only one thought. Sage. He kept no count of the men he killed or maimed to get to her. Most were fleeing, not fighting. But he made no distinction as he cut his way through them. They were obstacles, nothing more. Cassock was already there, bent over Sage, near a river of fire flowing out and around a huge mound of dirt and glass. Alex fell to his knees beside her and took everything in. Cass had already stripped away the affected clothing, though Alex suspected most of it had burned off. Her left arm and leg lay exposed, red and blistered, with sickening patches of black. But she didn't look in danger of burning more. He felt her neck, praying for a pulse, and found it. Shallow and rapid. Alive, but unconscious, which was better for her. Flames spewed from the top of the pile of earth. The stones themselves seemed to be melting, though it was hard to tell through the waves of heat. Molten streams advanced slowly, sputtering out of cracks between the rocks near the base. He needed to move her, but how to pick her up? If he cradled her on her left, he would grind against her wounds, but he could shelter them better. From the other side, he'd still have to hold her, perhaps centering pressure in places that would damage her further.
I need a blanket, he shouted to Cassock.
His friend pushed to his feet and ran. Alex put his arm under Sage's shoulders and pulled her up and against him, putting his mouth to her ear.
I'm here, Sage, he whispered. Her back arched, and her eyelashes fluttered against his neck. Stay with me. I'm getting you out of here. He pressed his lips to her soot-smeared forehead. Spirit above, it was just like Charlie. The sound of a sword being drawn from a scabbard made him look up. Cassick stood between them and a Khemisar fighter dressed in Damoran clothing. Swirling tattoos decorated his exposed forearms. The man raised his hands, palms out, then slowly reached up to push the hood of his cloak back. He wasn't very much older than Alex himself, but he looked much wearier. His brown eyes looked past Cassick to Alex cradling Sage, and there was recognition, though Alex couldn't recall ever seeing this man before. Get back! Cassick shouted through the roar of fire and smoke. They didn't have more than a minute to get Sage out of here. The man shook his head and pulled his hands around to undo the clasp at his neck. Slowly and deliberately, he shrugged off his cloak and held it out.
Take it, he said in Damoran. Carry her away.
The Khemisar was armed with knives at his belt, so Cass reached for the cloak without lowering his sword. As soon as Cassick had it, the man retreated, hands in the air again, until he faded into the smoke. Alex didn't even consider that it might be a trick, but Cassick never turned his back on the spot where the man had vanished as he brought the cloak to them. After a moment's hesitation, he jammed his sword in the ground and spread the rough cloth next to Sage. Alex grabbed an edge and pulled it under her torso and rolled the rest of her onto it, so she lay on her uninjured side. Then they folded the end around her, making a hammock. Alex grabbed his sword and stood, and they lifted her, together.
This way,
he shouted, tugging his end. Cassick followed him into the smoke. Chapter 110. She lay at an angle, so her weight rested on her right side and her back. Her left side was almost too painful to comprehend. It both throbbed and stabbed with a thousand daggers. Yet it was better than the first time she woke, when they'd been cleaning sand and dirt from the wounds. Her jaw still ached from biting down on the leather strap they'd put in her mouth. She'd screamed and thrashed at first, until she became aware of Alex holding her against him where he could. He was whispering in her ear, trying to soothe her, but his own choking sobs were impossible to hide. She focused on his voice and managed to quiet down, and also stopped fighting, other than the twitches and jerks she couldn't help, and tears from Alex's face fell and mingled with hers. Now a moist fabric lay over her body to keep her wounds from drying too much. Most of the outside of her leg, her hip, and the middle section of her arm had been burned to huge, painful blisters that ran into one another and burst before sloughing off, leaving weeping rawness behind. A spot on her thigh and another on her calf, plus one on her upper arm, had burned to the point of charring. Her hand, though, protected by her thick glove, had only been comparatively singed. She only ever looked at her burns once. That was more than enough. Alex took almost exclusive care of her, being gentle when she needed it, but also tough when she resisted. Every few hours he spread a pungent, oily balm over her burns, murmuring apologies for hurting her, but she no longer needed the strap to get through it. Twice daily, he forced her to stretch and move her arm and leg in multiple directions, saying it was necessary to keep muscles and tendons and skin limber. During those exercises, she unleashed torrents of obscenities at him, but he only smiled and told her she needed to be more creative. Every hour he made her drink water and broth, laced with sedatives, she was sure. Claire was often there as well, stroking her hair, as Alex washed away the dead skin every day. Her friend's face was drawn and pale, and her red-rimmed eyes never focused on Sage, even as she talked to distract her from Alex's work. Despite the haze of pain and medicines,
Sage was never able to forget Lieutenant Gramwell, or how he'd died. But she didn't know how to tell Claire how sorry she was.
"Did we stop the invasion?" she asked Alex one day.
Alex nodded. "Once the army was severed, most of the Khimasar scattered. I don't think Kasman or Demora needs to worry about an invasion through here for many, many years. There's a wall of black glass blocking the way, thanks to you."
Another time she asked about Gramwell, but she wasn't surprised when Alex said they hadn't found him. He was probably buried under the wall of melted stone. Her beautiful sword, too, was gone. She was the only one bothered by that. Banith said he'd have a new one made as soon as they returned to Ostheza.
"Like your friend, it perished in saving us, and there is no greater honor," he told her.
That sentiment wasn't likely to console Claire. It was almost 2 weeks before Banith and Alex agreed that Sage could be moved. They traveled slowly for the benefit of the wounded, of which there were many. All told, over a dozen Norsari had been lost either on the ridge or in the bowl, plus 10 other Demoran soldiers. Banith would be leaving behind about 40 of his own men, and Sage cried for a day when she heard Derrett had survived, but lost his left arm. Before they put her in the wagon, Alex wrapped her burns in bandages for the first time and helped her into an outfit Claire had tailored to cover her where her skin could be touched. It was an awkward-looking affair that laced in strange places to make it easy to get on and off, but it was better than the blankets that kept slipping. Until they were moving, however, Sage hadn't appreciated being as still as they'd kept her. The constant rocking of the wagon set off waves of pain, reminiscent of the first few days. And after an hour, she begged for more of the opiates Alex had been weaning her off of. Alex frowned, but allowed it. By the 10th day of travel, she needed higher and more frequent doses to keep the pain at bay. And she'd grown to like the hazy hours when she didn't have to think or remember what had happened. When Sage asked for a sedative that night after they'd stopped, and Alex refused, she screamed at him. He tried to gather her in his arms, and she fought him until the pain was too great, and she collapsed against him, weeping.
"I'm sorry," he whispered as he rocked her. "I shouldn't have let it go on as long as I did, but I couldn't stand to see you in pain."
"Then let me have it," she sobbed. "I want to forget." Alex looked stricken.
"Forget what, Sage?"
"Gramwell. Charlie." She kept going. "The guards in the barracks, the men on the river, the Khimasar in the pass. I killed them all."
Alex said nothing, but continued to hold her.
"And me,"
she finished. "You?"
It was selfish. She was alive, and she should be grateful. Yet that wasn't how she felt.
He kissed the top of her head. "You'll heal, Sage. It just takes time."
Sage didn't want to say it, but she was in too much pain to stop the words. "I'll be scarred all over."
"Yes, probably."
Alex's lopsided smile was belied by the tears in his eyes.
"You'll have me beaten for battle wounds. I don't know if I'll be able to live that down."
She tried to laugh, but instead, the fears and emotions she'd drugged away for the last weeks came rushing in at once, demanding to be felt. Sage could only cry uncontrollably as they hit her in wave after wave. Alex remained silent, but held her to him, even after she fell asleep, exhausted.
Chapter 111 The next days ran together in one long, terrible stretch of time. She was dimly aware that Alex insisted on stopping for her, but Banith and Claire and most of their group moved on. The only pain relief Alex would let her have was that which came from the burn salve he still applied several times a day, and it wasn't nearly enough. Her mood swung wildly between rage and depression, and very little of what she ate she kept down. She tried appealing to Kasich, but he shook his head sadly and sided with Alex. No one would listen, so Sage screamed and threw fits and lapsed into sullen silence for hours. Or she lay weeping, too sad to even lift her head. At times, she was so cold, she shook as though caught in a blizzard. Then suddenly, she would be gasping with heat, sweat soaking her hair and dripping into her wounds, burning like molten lead. And there was pain. Always pain. Pain that itched, and pain that stabbed, pain that rolled like thunder and struck like lightning. Her skin felt like it was sewing itself together, or crawling with insects. They tied her hands and feet together like a slaughtered hog to keep her from scratching. Nightmares, too, came. She dreamed of fire, of being trapped under a melting wall of black glass. One night, she dreamed of cutting her burned limbs off, and the look of horror when Alex saw her. Yet even in her nightmares, he never left her, and he was always there when she woke, hoarse from screaming. Once, she saw her father, or thought she did. He walked into the camp and sat by the fire without looking at her, even when she called out to him. Then Alex came over and forced her to look in his eyes while she tried to tell him what she saw, and he insisted she was wrong. When she looked again, Father was gone, and she cried all night. Then one morning, she woke feeling clear-headed and alert, and hungry. She carefully pushed herself into a sitting position, wincing with the pain, and looked around. They were camped at the base of two stone columns, the Protector's Gate. So they were near Ostheza. Alex lay nearby, a bucket she remembered vomiting into repeatedly near his head. There were dark circles under his eyes, and dirty trails of tears on his cheeks. Movement by the smoldering campfire caught her eye, and she saw Kasich squatting next to it, coaxing it back to life in the gray light of dawn. He jumped a little when he saw her. A few seconds later, he was untying her wrists and giving her a cup of water to drink. "How are you feeling?" he asked quietly. "Like a newborn foal," she answered. Her hands wouldn't stop shaking, but it was different from how they'd shaken and writhed for the last few days. It felt cleaner somehow. "What happened?"
"We had to let the medicine work itself out of your system. I've heard of it being done with those recovering from severe injury, but it's quite different to watch it happen."
Cass glanced over at Alex.
"He never left your side."
Memory surfaced in her mind, but she wasn't sure which were real and which were hallucinations. "Did I ever hit him?"
Cass smiled ruefully. "Once or twice. Mostly you scratched. But with your injuries, it was hard to restrain you too much."
Her cheeks burned with shame. "How long did it take?"
"This is the 8th morning."
8 days. She dropped the cup and put her hands over her eyes, her left arm throbbing with the movement. Alex stirred and sat up, instantly awake.
"What's happening?"
"I think she's finally out of the woods," Cass said, refilling the cup with water.
Alex crawled toward her, and Sage reached out to touch the streaks of red on his face and neck. She had done that.
"I'm sorry," she sobbed. "Oh, Alex, I'm so sorry."
"No, no,"
he said, pulling her carefully into his strong arms, the way he'd learned to do over the past weeks.
"It's over, love."
Alex rocked her and stroked her hair as he kissed her again and again.
"I'm just glad to have you back."
Chapter 112. They stayed in Ostheza 2 more weeks. By then, most of Sage's burned skin had grown over, shiny and pink, and itchy as hell. At least she was wearing full clothes again. She still craved the relief of the opiates they'd given her. Twice, she'd broken down crying. Alex stayed with her when that happened, never judging,
just holding her tightly, and whispering that he knew she was strong enough to get through it, telling her over and over, until she believed it, too.
Claire avoided her most of the time. So much that for the first 2 days after Ambassador Gramwell, Colonel Traysden, and Nicholas left for Vinova, Sage had thought she went with them. She'd been afraid to ask, not wanting to admit her friend had left without saying goodbye. But on the third day, Claire appeared in her doorway. Sage was sorting dresses and trying to decide which to take back to Demora. At the sound of Claire clearing her throat, Sage looked up in surprise and dropped her handful of silk. For a half minute, they looked at each other awkwardly. Then Claire strode in and stopped in front of her.
"I hate you," she said. "I hate you because you lived and he died. I hate you because he died saving your life. I hate you because you still have Captain Quinn, and I have..."
Claire choked. All Sage could do was stand there as her friend fought to bring herself under control.
"Lonnie told me to say all that. She said it would make me feel better."
"Do you feel better?" Sage asked. Claire shook her head as tears spilled down her cheeks.
"I feel worse now because I don't mean it. I'd miss you just as much as him. More."
"Claire, I'd do anything to bring him back. If I thought I could go back and dig him out with my bare hands, I would."
"I know," said Claire, sniffing and wiping her eyes. "I'm sorry."
"You have nothing to be sorry for.
How can you be so forgiving?"
Sage sat on the edge of the bed and shifted her dress around the sensitive skin on her leg.
"Because I understand. When Father died, I hated everyone, even those who took care of me." "How long did it take for you to get over it?" Claire whispered.
"Years. Sometimes I think I'm still not over it." She squeezed Claire's hand. "But it really didn't get better until I talked about him with friends. You're way ahead of me."
Benna threw a banquet for Sage's last night in Ostiza. Lonnie had all of Sage's favorite foods prepared and wanted to talk the whole time about Sage and Alex's wedding plans.
"Lonnie, it's still almost a year and a half away."
Sage glanced nervously at Claire, whose grasp of the Kazmuni language was good enough to understand what they were talking about.
"I think I will come visit you next summer so we can plan it."
Lonnie tossed her long black braid over her shoulder.
"You are welcome in Demora any time, but it gets very cold in the winter. Then I will have to find someone to keep me warm," said Lonnie airily.
She cast her eyes on Lieutenant Kasich, who was eating at her right hand, completely unaware of what had just been said. Sage nearly choked.
Lonnie shrugged. "I'm in no rush, though. Demoran men can't marry until they're 24 anyway."
"That's only Demoran army officers," Sage gasped after she swallowed her mouthful.
"Same difference," Lonnie said, taking a sip of wine.
She caught Kasich's eye and smiled. He blinked in surprise and smiled back, oblivious.
Baneth leaned closer to Sage and spoke in a low voice. "I suggest you teach that one more than please and thank you before we meet again. Otherwise, she will talk him into something he doesn't understand."
The journey north was uneventful. Baneth accompanied them until they reached the last major town along the Kaz River. From there, they headed north to Vinova. But Ambassador Gramwell wasn't there, so they rested briefly before pushing to the Jovan Road. Over dinner at an inn one night, they were met with a number of dispatches from Tenegal. Alex passed out dozens of scrolls to the men with him. Every Norsari received a commendation from the king, and Sage and Claire had ones specially addressed to them. Alex read Sage's over her shoulder from his seat next to her on the bench, while she blushed and nudged him away with her shoulder.
"Not bad for an 18-year-old," he said. "Of course, I had two or three of these by your age."
You did not.
He grinned and kissed the tip of her nose.
No, I didn't.
What are the rest of the messages about? She asked.
Let's see.
Alex dug through the satchel.
The last two have seals of official orders, rather than those fancy ribbons. For me and the Norsari here, and...
Alex broke off, as he saw the two silver pins attached to the scroll. Sage leaned over to look.
Promotion to major, huh? Not bad for someone your age.
Alex shook his head.
It's unheard of.
He pulled the pins off and stuffed them in his pocket.
Don't tell anyone. I can't even wear them anyway, since I don't have a uniform. They'd look really strange with this.
He gestured to his Kazmuni breeches and vest.
What's the other one? Sage asked.
Alex squinted at the writing on the outside of the second scroll.
This one's yours. Uncle Raymond has plans for you, apparently.
Interesting, Sage said, taking it.
She broke the seal, and a smaller, unofficial-looking note with three distinct handwritings fell out. Sage opened it first, finding a personal letter from the Queen and the two princesses.
Dearest Sage, I can never express my gratitude for what you have done in protecting my son from harm. He has told us the story many times, and we all look forward to hearing your more modest account of events. But I suspect that will have to wait. You have more important duties now, which will serve the realm as a whole. But we will miss you all the same. Please remember that if there is anything I can do for you, you need only ask, as I am forever in your debt. Most sincerely, Oriana March Devlin.
The other paragraphs scrawled at the bottom were from Rose and Corinthia, begging her to remember them fondly, with a heavy hint from Rose that she was more than willing to visit, should Sage feel lonely. They were all referring to what must be on the official scroll, which Sage now realized she should have read first. A knot formed in her stomach as she unrolled a royal proclamation.
Following the permanent retirement of Ambassador Lord Gramwell, Mistress Sage Fowler is hereby requested by His Majesty, King Raymond II, to serve as ambassador to the nation of Kazmun, effective immediately, representing the Crown in matters concerned with opening and establishing trade routes and laws, judging matters of Damoran citizens in Kazmun, representing Damoran interests, and maintaining open and clear communication between our nations. For the time being, the post shall reside at the fortress of Vinova, near the boundary of the two lands, and all honors and necessities provided for the office and its duties. Signed, H.M. Raymond II.
Sage froze with the letter in her hands. The honor and trust of the position were dizzying, but her heart sank, and she looked up with tears in her eyes. Alex had his mouth scrunched to one side as he read his orders.
Pretty much what I expected. Back to the capital for more recruits, and then out for training. He wants to expand the Norsari to a full battalion by next summer. Must be why the promotion.
He handed the orders to Cass, and frowned at her expression.
What's wrong?
He's named me Ambassador to Kazmun.
But that's wonderful,
Alex said, grabbing the paper to read it himself. His face fell as he read it.
Vinova,
he whispered.
Sage shook her head. I'm not going with you.
Kasik was reading the Norsari's orders aloud to those in the tavern to great enthusiasm, but neither Sage nor Alex paid the noise any attention. Without a word, Alex took her by the hand and led her upstairs to her room, then bolted the door behind him and wrapped her in his arms.
I thought we'd be together until at least Tenegal, she choked.
Alex rubbed her back and laid his cheek on top of her head.
Me too.
I hate this.
I know, but it's too late for me to take up farming now.
Sage laughed weakly and wiped her eyes on his shirt breathing him in. Spirit above, they only had hours left.
The decision is yours, Alex whispered. But you can turn it down. You've already given so much.
She snorted. You know I won't. Not when the kingdom needs me.
Both kingdoms need you, yes, I know. It was just wishful thinking.
He continued, holding her against him. I'll keep Claire with me. I ought to have a companion, and she knows so much already. She can't be sent back to her father. He's awful. He'll have her married off to someone else within a month.
I'll tell Uncle Raymond. I'm sure he'll be fine with it.
And Alex? Her fingers curled around folds in his shirt. Stay with me tonight, please. We only have a few hours left. He swallowed.
All right, just promise me.
She nodded. I'll be good, I promise.
Well,
Alex smiled crookedly, and her heart skipped a beat.
I wouldn't mind if you were a little bad.
Epilogue. A few days after the battle, Hazar led all the Khemisar survivors he could gather across the southern pass. He'd approached the Kazmuni camp alone after it was all over, carrying a makeshift flag of truce, and asked for Captain Quinn. When the Damorin met him, he recognized Hazar immediately and called for his cloak to be brought to him. That had been the last thing Hazar expected, but he accepted it with a thank you.
No, Quinn had said. Thank you.
Hazar folded the cloak over his tattooed arm.
Will she live?
A ripple of pain had passed over the Damorin's features.
We can only hope right now. She's strong, though.
Hazar smiled a little before clearing his throat.
I've come to request the release of my countrymen, that they may return home.
Quinn crossed his arms.
And why should I allow that?
Please, Hazar said simply.
We're only soldiers following orders. Surely you can understand that.
He waved an arm back at the pass.
The threat is gone. Let us go home.
Quinn eyed him for several seconds.
Your Damorin is quite good. Yes, I've spent a great deal of time in your country.
Quinn raised an eyebrow.
Apparently so.
Hazar looked down at his hands.
We were abandoned and stranded by your Damirans. Everything I've done in the past year was to return to Khemisara. I could not call myself a commander if I didn't always do my best to bring my men home.
Finally, Quinn had nodded.
I will speak to King Vaneth.
In the end, the Kazmuni king turned the prisoners over, and Hazar led them and the other survivors he'd found back into Khemisara, expecting to return to a nation in even more ruin than when he'd left almost 2 years ago. But there was nowhere else to go.
At least he could not be expected to return to war.
Most of the army had dissolved once word got out that King Ragat had been tossed from his horse and trampled in the rush to get away from the molten river of fire. Hazar and the survivors traveled slowly, carrying many wounded. They skirted the smoldering wall of black glass by using the rocky ledge above, but then followed the canyon through the mountains, not even bothering to set a rear guard. At the end of the pass, they found a supply train that had been abandoned and scavenged. As no one of higher rank was present, Hazar took responsibility for releasing the Khemisar with him from their military obligations. He then allowed himself a couple days to rest and scrounge supplies from the wreckage of the wagons before setting off with a few companions. Harvest time was approaching, and surely the place he should be was home. 3 days out, he was met on the road by royal troops. When they learned who Hazar was and where he'd been, they escorted him to the seat of the local barony, where regional judgments were made. For the first time in his life, Hazar was faced with royalty. Nearing 30, Queen Zariah had been half her husband's age
and still had the bloom of youth, with gold-bronze skin and hair so black it almost had a sheen of blue. Up close, one could see the lines in her face from the strain of years of barrenness, and then, having only one child to shield her from being disposed of as Ragat's two previous wives had been. Her son was now only 5, and heir to a land of ashes.
"My husband's ministers do not see fit to tell me all that has happened," she said, gripping the arms of the chair set up as a makeshift throne. "Perhaps you can shed some light on events."
Hazar told her everything that had happened since he'd left Kimisara. Though he knew nothing about the man, he heaped praise on King Ragat and his bravery in battle. But the queen snorted and rolled her eyes. When his tale finally ended, Zariah stood and paced in front of him on the dais.
"You've been a most loyal son of Kimisara, Captain, and I can never truly repay either the service you've rendered or your honesty to me now."
"I live only to serve my queen," he said.
She stopped in front of him.
"You must understand how precarious my position is. My son is king, and I may be regent by law, but I am flouted at every turn by those who would usurp my position and take power for themselves."
"What is it my queen wishes of me?"
"The country is recovering from the famine, but the king's death and the failure of his campaign may throw it back into chaos. I need to project strength and create stability. I need men of honesty and loyalty."
She held out her right hand, her sapphire blue eyes piercing his soul.
"May I count on your service?"
Hazar stared at the bejeweled rings on every finger of the queen's smooth hand.
"May I first ask what my queen plans to do? Forgive me, but I cannot see where a mere captain can assist."
The hand dropped.
"I will first sue for peace with Demora and Kazmun. This fighting must stop. You, who have such wide knowledge of both nations, will attend this process, but you will be loyal to me, not the ministers or generals. I need your help to keep them from going behind my back and undermining my goals. Now,"
she raised her hand again, "may I count on you?"
"Let this end. Let this be done. Let me go home."
Hazar trembled as he knelt and took the hand she offered, kissing the 4-pointed star of Kimisara on the ring on her middle finger.
"Until death, my queen."
This is Kathleen McInerney. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Traitor's Ruin by Aaron Beatty. This program was directed by Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Text copyright 2018 by Aaron Beatty. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.